everybody, and thank you for joining us for the Preceptor Podcast. I'm Sarah.
And I'm Ryan. And today we have with us a returning guest, Dr. Mike Bodoroff. Mike, you want to introduce yourself for those who aren't familiar with your previous appearance?
Yeah, Mike Bodoroff. I've been teaching in pharmacy schools until I sort of almost retired last year for over 40 years. Always had an area and specialty in cardiology and rounded with cardiologists at University of Tennessee, University of Cincinnati, and just retired from Manchester this past August.
And we asked Mike here to talk a little bit about a new article that I know is getting a lot of buzz, especially in some anticoagulation circles. It's called The Effectiveness and Safety of Direct Oral Anticoagulants versus Warfarin in Patients with Valvular AFib. And it was published in the Annals of Internal Medicine. Just to quickly go over, could you kind of give us like a Reader's Digest version of what this article kind of was about?
Yeah, and really, to put it into the proper context, you probably need to go back a little bit and understand where this terminology of valvular versus non-valvular AFib came from. And in the original DOAC trials against warfarin, so that was the RELY trial with dabigatran, the Aristotle trial with apixaban, and the Rocket AF trial with rivaroxaban, they intentionally included patients with what were called having non-valvular AFib. Now, they could have had mild mitral stenosis or mild aortic regurgitation or something, but the reason they excluded people who would be called having valvular AFib is that those people would potentially end up leaving the trial to go have their valves replaced. And so it wasn't because no one believed DOACs would work in valvular AFib. They just didn't want those patients in the trial because they'd end up dropping out and affecting the power of the study. So that's the backdrop about this sort of terminology difference between valvular and non-valvular AFib. So the DOACs were specifically approved for that patient population, those with non-valvular AFib. So this study, getting back to the study, was a retrospective analysis trying to look at what I would call off-label use of DOACs versus warfarin in a large database where they had inpatient and outpatient claims data and pharmacy claims data to compare DOAC users in patients with valvular AFib versus warfarin, which would be sort of the standard of care in patients with valvular AFib. And I know one of the follow-up questions you guys like to usually ask is, you know, what are the limitations of the study? And so what I thought I'd do is, as we work through the trial details, in very summary format, I might list what could be considered a limitation as we go along, if that's okay.
That sounds perfect. Yeah, that sounds good.
So number one, this is a retrospective analysis, which is always something that you need to keep in mind. And it's based on claims data and the accuracy of the claims data that you're relying upon, and are people coded correctly? And important for any warfarin comparison trial, these kinds of claims databases don't have lab data or very limited lab data. So when you have an outcome with warfarin that's either bleeding, you don't know whether the INR was elevated or not. And if they had a stroke, you don't know if the INR was subtherapeutic or not. So you really don't have the full set of data that you would have from a prospective clinical trial. So the way they did the study is they collected data from January 2010 until June 2019 for what were called new users of either a DOAC or warfarin in AFib patients who had ICD-9 and then later ICD-10 codes for having valvular disease. And I would add that they excluded anybody who had a bioprosthetic valve or a mechanical prosthetic valve. So it's only those that had valvular disease that wasn't based on valve replacement surgery. So they came up with over 56,000 patients. So that's one of the advantages of this kind of study is that it's a huge database. It's not a small prospective study. It's a huge retrospective study. And then a lot of what these trials do is they try to match a one-to-one, a DOAC user who has an identical mate that's a warfarin user, on 43 characteristics, and you can invent as many of those as you want, that the age and history of hypertension, history of renal disease, history of heart failure, diabetes, you know, on and on and on. So each included patient had an exact match, whether they were a DOAC or a warfarin person. And again, a limitation is that's only as good as what you can predict. It's not, you know, the perfect way of doing it. And as you might expect, 55% of these people had mitral valve disease, 40% had aortic disease, which will be the two valvular disorders that would be most associated with atrial fibrillation. Some had multiple valves involved too. Mean exposure time following the pharmacy claims data was 4.5 months. Another limitation. You don't have any compliance data. You don't know how the results would compare if you followed for 6 months or 1 year or 2 years. Remember, the original DOAC trials against warfarin were 2 years in duration. So you have a much longer exposure period to make a valid comparison with. If people left the insurance plan and went to a different insurance plan, then they may have continued on, but you don't have the data. Or if they switched, they tried warfarin, they switched to a DOAC. They tried DOAC, they switched to a warfarin. You know, you don't want that kind of confusion in the trial either. Then they assessed for efficacy, which would be reduction in stroke or the incidence of stroke. And they always add in these trials systemic embolization, because some people get a clot from AFib, and instead of going straight to the brain like it typically does, maybe in 90% of patients, they'll get like a renal artery clot or thrombosis, something like that. But that's a small number of people. And then for safety, major bleeding, and they limited the major bleeding to ICD-9 or 10 codes for GI bleeds or intracranial hemorrhages. And so other bleeds, minor bleeds, we don't have that data. So that's a little bit of a limitation in this study relative to the big prospective trials. Nevertheless, over that short time period, compared to warfarin, collectively, the DOACs were associated with a 36% lower risk of stroke and systemic embolization, and a 33% lower risk of major bleeding. And when you think about that, what that means is that you have a stronger level, if you will, or consistency of anticoagulation without the risk of increased bleeding to go along with that. So it's almost like getting both sides of the dual-edged sword. You have better efficacy and better safety as well. And overall, that's pretty consistent with what the big major trials and non-valvular AFib showed as well. They did some individual comparisons. Again, you start dicing this down even further and it maybe loses a little bit of validity, but nevertheless, the rivaroxaban and apixaban individually did the same as the overall results, better both for safety and efficacy. And dabigatran by itself was only better for major bleeding, but was not better for stroke reduction. I'm not sure how I would interpret that overall. But over the course of this trial, remember from January 2010, dabigatran was the only agent on the market, you know, for almost 2 years. And so a lot of its data came during that time period. And then if you look in the subsequent years, its use dropped to almost nothing. And it's really a reflection of the two major players in this market, which are rivaroxaban and apixaban. So those are the ones that I have the most, I think, trust in the data. So that's the trial in a nutshell, and maybe not too surprising, given that there's nothing about valvular AFib that should behave any differently than non-valvular in terms of anticoagulation effect in an AFib patient.
Mike, I want to share this with all of the APPE students who are struggling with how to summarize a journal club thoroughly and succinctly, because I think you just did a great job of that, first of all. I want to get back.
Thank you.
Yeah, I want to get back to the results just for a second. So decreased incidence of stroke and decreased incidence of major bleeding were the main takeaways here. So it seems to me that this will or could impact practice in the future. Do you see that happening, or what's your read on how it's going to impact practice?
You know, it's a great question. And we have the trial purists who would say this is retrospective, it has all the limitations, and others that we could talk about. And so it's hypothesis generating is a very common term that the drug information specialist and literature evaluators would tell you. And I'm gonna argue with that a little bit. I think it's a well done study. It was out of the University of Pennsylvania, large database. There's no really pathophysiologic, hemodynamic, or whatever reason to not have a lot of faith in the results of this trial. And I know there's a lot of patients who don't want warfarin or shouldn't have warfarin. And just because they have valvular AFib, I don't think they should be denied the opportunity for these benefits from a DOAC. And so the author's conclusion, instead of saying, you know, we want to have a prospective huge trial that verifies these data, their perspective was, I think this validates enough the potential benefit of a DOAC in a valvular AFib patient that you should have a discussion with a patient who has AFib and valvular disease and say, do you want warfarin or do you want to maybe take advantage of what the results of this trial showed and sort of make a combined decision with a patient? And I think I'd rather support that concept than let's wait for a huge trial that's never going to happen.
I think one of the things in listening to you discuss this trial, one of the things I liked about it was that it is very real world. I know that one of our big concerns with people with DOACs is adherence. So this is actually kind of looking at real world, and we know adherence is not great all the time. Even if they're not adherent possibly, which probably a lot of these people weren't all the time, it still showed the benefit, which for me is very reassuring.
Yeah, if you assume whatever problems with that are not a lot different between the two groups that were studied in the trial, then they sort of cancel each other out is one way of looking at that. And I would argue that DOACs are probably easier to take than warfarin. And if there was an issue with adherence, it probably would be warfarin related in the real world, which is not unusual to expect at all.
Yeah, that's a good point. I know we talk a lot about how like warfarin has a long half-life. So if somebody's not going to be adherent, warfarin's kind of nice for that. But that having to remember to take 5 milligrams on Tuesdays and 3 all the other days or whatever is not fabulous either.
Man, I wish I could count how many of those kind of alternate crazy regimens that I changed into something that a patient could better manage. And people who came up with those, you know, based on warfarin algorithms, and I want to reduce the dose by 7%. And like, well, this drug isn't that precise.
Okay, so if our preceptors wanted to learn more about this, can you suggest any resources? I mean, outside of obviously going to look at the trial.
Yes and no. You know, there's a couple additional pieces of data. For example, some of the original DOAC trials actually included people who had had bioprosthetic valve replacement, which would be a form of valvular AFib, if you will. So there's some data out there that where those trials were analyzed just for that subset of people. And there's a recent small study that looked specifically at, I believe it was rivaroxaban's performance in a bioprosthetic valve replacement mitral valve patient population, and it did just fine. So that sort of adds to this overall database of being able to use DOACs in valvular AFib. I just want to make sure that that we do always put in there that if you have a mechanical valve anywhere, that DOACs are not to be used. Don't want to misrepresent the importance of that particular point. And then as always, the guidelines will catch up with this. So whenever the new set of guidelines come out, these kinds of things will be in there and give you some kind of strength of recommendation. It probably won't be a level one because of the retrospective nature, but I suspect it'll be a 2A.
I was just going to ask a closing question. I think you just answered it for me. But so I was going to ask, is with this information and all of the data that continues to come out on DOACs, is warfarin's time as a therapeutic agent limited? But I think we're always going to have those mechanical valve patients, right? So what are your thoughts on that?
I'm a drug dork, as you know, and not so much a surgical specialist, but they keep investigating with more and more valve types that might obviate the need for higher intensity warfarin therapy, let's say, in a mechanical mitral valve. So that may reduce the future need for warfarin for that specific population. I believe there's some data that some of the DOACs did not do quite so well in patients who had these genetic thrombophilic disorders. And so warfarin will probably get a little bit of a toehold that it keeps there. So I don't think it's totally dead at this point, but it's suffering a long, slow death, much like digoxin did for the last 20 years as well. So it'll have a much more limited application. And of course, now we're going to see the DOACs go generic. And so whatever cost issue people had a problem with, you know, that's going to go away as well. In fact, I know there's already two generics of apixaban that have been approved. So it's just a matter of time before we start seeing some generics on the market.
Absolutely. Well, Mike, thank you for sharing all this information. I really appreciate it. Always appreciate your expertise on these matters.
Thanks, guys.
And thank you all for joining us for this episode of the Pharmacy Preceptor Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please like or subscribe. We would love your feedback on topics that interest you and how we can make this podcast better. Please submit your comments to help us develop content that best serves you. Thanks, everyone.